I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Sherry Graydon joins me now. The award-winning women's advocate and best-selling author has just edited a new collection, I Feel Great About My Hands and Other Unexpected Joys of Aging. It's a fun collection of essays, poems, and stories by 41 women who talk about growing older. Hitting the age of 50 is often considered going downhill the mountain of life. But the pieces herein prove otherwise. They're often informative, sometimes funny, sometimes poignant, and always interesting. Even the close-to-30 male who welcomes Miss Graydon to this program now found some wisdom in the pieces here. Some of the people who contribute include former guests to this program, Lorna Crozier and Lindsay Green, political figures Elizabeth May and Sharon Carstairs, journalists Susan Delacourt and Frances Beulah, as well as other well-known figures like Mary Walsh and Susan Musgrave. The website for more is at sherrygraydon.com. The book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Sherry Graydon. Good morning, Ms. Graydon.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, and thank you for finding resonance in a book that, you know, you're not remotely the target audience for.
Yeah. Do you find that the people that this book isn't for perhaps are reading it?
Actually, I am, and it's been very interesting to have men come to some of the launch events and to have 20-something-year-old women come up at the end of the readings and say, one woman in Ottawa said, I can't wait to be 50 after listening to some of the women read from their excerpts. So it's been very, very gratifying to notice the amount of resonance that's occurred from the very human stories that are told in the book.
Now, you put this together, you wrote and edited this collection, in response to Nora Ephron's book, is that right?
In part, it was a response to Nora Ephron's book. Certainly the title is a riff on Nora Ephron's book, but really the inciting incident was a column in a newspaper a couple of years ago where the columnist, who I ordinarily read with interest, devoted her entire 24 inches to cataloging the litany of gravity-prone, wrinkle-challenged parts of a woman's body and their derogatory nicknames. And I was so incensed that I considered writing a letter to the editor, but, you know, you only get 250 words, and I couldn't contain my fury in 250 words. And so instead I fired off an email to 50 and then ultimately 80 women, inviting them to contribute something that would counter the kind of messaging we already get about how negative aging is, and to celebrate some of the benefits of maturity.
Who's the columnist?
You know, I haven't revealed that. I'm still hoping the newspaper will give me a positive review.
Ah, there we go, yeah. Did you ask her to contribute to this book?
I didn't. No. I probably should have. You know, In retrospect, that was probably a strategic error. But given that she was prepared, I used to write a column for the Vancouver Sun, and I felt every week that I had this extraordinary privilege to send a memo about something that I thought was important to an audience of hundreds of thousands of people. And so never in my wildest dreams would I ever have wasted an inch, let alone 24 inches, on lamenting women's physical decline. So I guess I had a bias against her, I have to say.
So how did it work? You mentioned that you contacted 50 and then it became 80 women asking them for pieces. I guess these are all pieces in the book that haven't appeared elsewhere too, right?
A couple of them have appeared elsewhere.
Okay.
So Lorna Crozier's poem, My Last Erotic Poem, which is a really funny, beautiful piece, had appeared previously. It was published in the Globe and Mail a few years ago, and I think it's now in a collection that she's written. But it was so perfect and wonderful, and when she offered it to me, of course I accepted. Another poet represented in the book, Susan McMaster, has a few poems about her mother's descent into Alzheimer's, which doesn't sound very uplifting, but is surprisingly uplifting, and her pieces also appeared. But all of the rest of the pieces are original to the book.
Are these people you know? Are they friends of yours?
Many of them are people I knew. They wouldn't necessarily all be classified as friends, but they're people I knew, admired, had come into contact with. many of them I didn't know at all, and I was delighted that they responded to my email or that somebody else introduced me to them. So Lynn Miles, who's a Juno Award-winning, fabulous singer-songwriter based in Ottawa, I didn't know her prior to the book, but somebody introduced us, and she donated the lyrics to one of her songs called Rust, which is a really lovely, evocative poem in its form in the book. So there's a mix of people I knew and people I didn't.
Were there people that you wanted for the book but didn't get, like you weren't able to get?
Certainly there were women I invited who declined for various reasons. Margaret Atwood was in the middle of a big book tour and simply didn't have time. There were a number of women who, let me tell you this, that every woman I approached said she'd like to read the book.
Yeah.
A number of them said, what exactly would those benefits be, Sherry? So a few of them were attitudinally challenged, let's put it that way, and sometimes that was because I explicitly wanted people to celebrate the advantages, and there were some people who, when I approached them, weren't in a celebratory frame of mind, either because they were experiencing physical health challenges themselves or they just lost somebody close to them, and so those women ended up not writing. But at the end of the day, 40 of the 80 or so I approached sent me something fine and good, and I'm delighted to have them in the book.
Now, one review or one column about the book from the Vancouver Sun, I think, if I recall correctly, said that the only shortcoming of this collection was that the women in it, there was a sort of a sameness in the socio-political tone of the contributors. Do you care to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Shelley Freilich's article, she referred to that, and she asked me that when we spoke on the phone a week or so ago, and she laments in her review that there are no Rosedale socialites, I think she refers to.
Right.
And let me say, as I told her, I did in fact invite a few people who might have fit that particular stereotype or demographic, and if they're not represented in the book, it's because they declined to contribute. So, you know, I don't know if you can make generalizations about that, but I cast the net as wide as I could, both geographically, age-wise. The contributors range from 50 to over 80. They are represented from coast to coast. There are artists and lawyers and musicians and businesswomen and politicians. And so the book, in fact, does reflect quite a bit of diversity. If more of the contributors are left-leaning than not, you know, I guess you could conclude that maybe left-leaners are more inclined to celebrate aging than their more conservative sisters. I'm not sure.
What do you know now about growing older that you didn't know before?
I certainly have a much enriched perspective on the benefits. I mean, when I conceived of the book, I had a few ideas of the things that I appreciate. Certainly I feel like I have more perspective and confidence than I did in my 20s or 30s, but the insights that were shared by the women who contributed were vast, and some of them, you know, not things that I would have thought about or considered or articulated, and yet when they referred to them, I thought, yeah, actually, it's true. I do feel that way. I do feel more grateful today and less inclined to obsess over the small things than I might have 20 or 30 years ago.
And knowing what you know now, would you go back and live life differently?
You know, the one thought I had about how I would live differently, and I say this in my introduction, is when I was working on the book, I was moving, and I came across a box of videotapes of commentary that I had done on CBC television in the mid-1990s, and I found doing TV commentary really stressful because I was always critical of the way I looked on television, and when I sat down at the age of 49 or 50 and popped the videotape into the television and looked at myself 15 years earlier, I thought, what was my problem? Because with, you know, the benefit of 15 years, I think, boy, I looked pretty good then.
Yeah.
And so one of the resolves that came to me was that, you know, how I look today is inevitably going to be better than how I'm going to look 10 years from now. And so I'd better start enjoying how I look now, because it's only going to get, you know, gravity and age is going to continue to have its effects.
And do you think, I mean, how much of, I mean, I probably already know the answer to my question, but how much of what you think about, what women think about in terms of how they look comes from, I guess, sort of popular culture and what society expects?
It's so huge. It's so huge. I think, in fact, somebody was telling me just the other day that there was British research looking at asking men and women in Britain at what age they feel old, and men said 58, and women said, I hope you're sitting down, 29.
Wow.
And I think the onslaught of messages from media, from pop culture, from the multi-billion-dollar cosmetic industry is such that women are reminded on a daily basis, repeatedly, of how we need to purchase products and buy services and inject our faces with Botox and get plastic surgery and apply makeup and creams and all of that stuff in order to be physically acceptable. And, you know, men, I'm sure, have those doubts and insecurities, but they're not targeted in remotely the same way. And so it's very clear that that's one of the reasons that aging for women has so much more, it's so much more fraught. And so this book for me really works at countering that by emphasizing the other things, the doing as opposed to the appearing. And the women's voices in the book really reflect that, reflect the recognition that at the end of the day, you know, when we're lying on our deathbeds, very few of us are going to say, damn it, I wish I'd spent more time in front of the mirror making myself look better.
Do you think we'll get to that point? I mean, get away from that point, I should say?
As a culture?
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope that the pendulum is swinging so far into the realm of artificiality in terms of appearance that eventually we get to start really appreciating authenticity when we see it. I mean, I'm already there. I really like going to movies with Helen Mirren, just because here is this woman in her 60s who is vibrant and sexy and healthy and dynamic and has not seemed to have, you know, slipped into the realm of Botox and plastic surgery. And so, you know, I hope that eventually we, as a culture, start appreciating that. I think it was the Queen Mother who protested somebody offering to airbrush one of her photographs by saying, you know, I earned every one of those wrinkles, so back off.
Yeah. I'm sure there are women who are under 50 listening to us. And you mentioned sort of the 20-year-olds that come up to you at book readings and signings and who say that they can't wait to be 50. What advice do you give people who are perhaps worried about turning 50 or growing older?
Well, certainly I would say, you know, the impact and success, unless you are an actor or a TV broadcaster or somebody who makes their living on the basis of your appearance, for most of us, what we do and how we respond to people and how we engage in the world is always going to have a much bigger impact on the happiness and success you have in life than how we look. And the sooner we get that, and the sooner we get that it's about intelligence and grace and generosity and resilience as opposed to, you know, the physical packaging, I think the easier it is. And it has struck me, and this was also reflected in terms of conversations I had with women when I was inviting them to contribute, that women who are stereotypically beautiful in their younger years and who are celebrated for that, it's much more difficult for them to grow old than it is for those of us who had to get by on our wits and intelligence from the get-go, because we're, you know, the loss is not as significant. So, you know, really focusing on what you do as opposed to how you appear is one of the critical factors. And I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, the alternative to growing old is not remaining young. It's dying young. Mm. And I lost my eldest sister during the process of editing this book, and that really underlined for me that, you know, aging is something we all do, and it's not so bad when you consider the alternative.
And we mentioned this off the top that I'm not your typical reader, the reader for the book. I'm not the target audience. But there are things in here that a male can learn from. Looking back at the book now and the pieces therein, what do you think the guy, say, could get from this book?
Well, I think many of the issues are certainly relatable for male readers. And, you know, I think it's interesting. A few men have asked me this question about, you know, how would this be different if men were talking about these issues. And I think men tend not to talk about these issues so much. So women are under so much pressure, appearance-wise, and so we do obsess and we talk about it. And I think the value of the book for men is that they get to participate in the conversation, that a conversation that they may not ordinarily have, but which, of course, they can relate to, because they, too, are aging and are losing their physical capacity or having their appearance compromised. And you know, human beings are human beings, and although some of the insights relate specifically to things like menopause or being a mother, men are parents too. Men gain confidence with years of experience. They lose their attachment perhaps to things that are not so important. So I hope that the book does resonate with male readers as well.
It's sort of like a conversation that we're listening into, I think.
Yeah, that's maybe more what it is for male readers, because they're less participants. Whereas, you know, when we've done events and the audiences have been mostly women, the readings are invariably interrupted by laughter of recognition from the women in the room who have gone through exactly the same shift in perspective or experience that that the authors are relating.
Now, you mentioned that you sort of went through this process of accepting, sort of the growing older process. Who did you look to that you perhaps admired, that did this well, that aged gracefully, if you will?
My mother is she's just turned 80, and she was always a role model for me of an independent woman who, you know, was clearly doing and being in the world as opposed to appearing. Not that she wasn't attractive or didn't care about her appearance. She has great style, but she always worked. She was ambitious. She was effective. And so she has always certainly been a role model for me. And she's almost blind now. She's had macular degeneration for 15 years. Very difficult thing to lose your eyesight, but you know, she turned to talking books. She manages to get around. If you met her in her own home, you'd have no idea that she couldn't see. So she's not defined by the aging challenges that she's experienced. So she's certainly been a significant role model.
I read somewhere that you're working on another book.
I joke in my bio in the book that I'm working on a sequel, and it's called "And Did I Mention My Legs?"
Uh-huh.
That was sort of a joke, but I have to tell you, since the book's been out, and it's only been out for a little over a month, a number of the women who didn't contribute, even when I asked them, have since talked to me and said, "Boy, I'm so wishing I had gotten it together and written you something." And I've had conversations with a number of other women who I think would have something really interesting to say based on the conversations we've had. Three women I spoke to prior to producing the book were going to write about the experience of being a mother in their 50s as opposed to in their 20s or 30s, and none of them ultimately ended up writing me something. So I think there's lots more to say on the subject, and if there's enough appetite, it would be great to do a second book sometime.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, the process of editing the pieces. You'd commission the piece, they'd get it back to you. Was there much editing that you had to do? Say you had to cut parts of it out in the sort?
Yeah, some of them I edited more than others. Some of them by, you know, like Susan Musgrave, Lorna Crozier, these are award-winning, fabulous authors who required virtually no editing. Some of the women I invited were not primarily writers, and so those pieces I had a little bit more to do with. And there were a few pieces that were submitted that really didn't work for one reason or another within the context of the book as I envisioned it. And they were, you know, interesting in and of themselves, but didn't quite work. So it was really a range. Some of them I edited quite a bit, and many others hardly at all.
You don't like Will Ferrell as an actor?
I make a crack about Will Ferrell, no. It's true. I have enjoyed some of his movies. My crack is I'm talking about Nora Ephron and how it's hard to feel sympathetic for a fabulous, successful Hollywood screenwriter who gets to hang out with people like Meryl Streep and Will Ferrell, and then I sort of joke, well, it's hard for me to imagine having a real conversation with Will Ferrell because he always plays these kind of bizarre guys, but yeah, I don't mind him.
Yeah. Whose hands are they on the cover?
They're my hands, and thank you so much for asking. When I pitched the book to Douglas and McIntyre, I had already identified the title of my essay, and that would be the title of the collection, and Scott McIntyre said to me, as a publisher would, don't get too attached to the title, because as a publisher, we get to choose that.
Uh-huh.
And but I was already attached to the title, so I went to a fabulous photographer near my home in Ottawa, and she took dozens of spectacular photographs of my hands, and we sent them to Douglas and McIntyre, and you know, then it was difficult for them to come up with another title because I had so imprinted on their perspective the thought of this image of really strong hands on the cover of the book. And, you know, my attachment to the title was partly because the success of Nora Ephron's book, I Feel Bad About My Neck, I knew that that would have resonance. People would see the title, and if they had seen and liked her book, there would be at least the incentive to pick it up.
Sherry, I've enjoyed this conversation today. I've known you for years, back when you guys were out here, and I've admired David's work for years, so it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with this book.
A pleasure for me, too, Joseph. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The website for more, sherrygraydon.com. The book is called I Feel Great About My Hands and Other Unexpected Joys of Aging. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its editor, Sherry Graydon, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.